Welcome back to the Burn Bag Podcast. My name is Ryan Rosenthal, joined as always by my co-host, Andre Ganuela. And today we are absolutely honored and privileged to be joined by Admiral James Stavridis. He is a retired four-star U.S. naval officer, has a quite impressive background, having led the NATO alliance and global operations from 2009 to 2013 as Supreme Allied Commander. He also was commander of U.S. Southern Command, and in his career commanded the top ship in the Atlantic Fleet. And of following his career in the U.S. military, he was the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and is currently an operating executive of the Carlyle Group, as well as the chair of the board of counselors of McClarty Associates. He has a PhD in international relations, has written 9 books, hundreds of articles, is a speaker who travels around the world, contributes to Time Magazine. Admiral, I can go on and on and on, but I also want to mention your forthcoming book, 2034, A Novel on the Next World War. There's already a brief snippet of it around the internet. You can view it on Wired. I've read it. It seems fascinating. I'm excited to pick up your book. And so, Admiral, once again, thank you very much for joining us. We are thrilled to have you on today.
Ryan and Andre, my pleasure. Always happy to do these podcasts because you hit different audiences, different times, different thoughts can kind of move around. Thanks for mentioning my book, 2034, A Novel of the Next World War. As you would probably guess, if you are a regular listener to Burn Bag Podcast, the biggest security concern we ought to have in this 21st century is how do we avoid a war with China? So this book, 2034, is about how to avoid it in the sense that it's cautionary fiction. It's not predictive. It is kind of like the old Cold War books, Dr. Strangelove, The Bedford Incident, Failsafe. I've always said that the great security challenges require not only intelligence, but they require imagination. We have to think our way through. So the story opens in the South China Sea on a destroyer, simultaneously in the air over the Arabian Gulf, simultaneously in the White House with the National Security Council staff. Events kind of unfold in a way that puts the U.S. and China, if you will, sleepwalking into a war. So it's a book that is meant to arouse people's interest. And you mentioned Wired magazine, which I would guess a lot of listeners to the Burn Bag read Wired. The entire February issue, the print edition, the entire issue is an excerpt from 2034, A Novel of the Next World War. It's about 30% of the book, so you still have to buy the book. Book comes out on March 9th. I hope it's well received. It's gotten some terrific reviews coming out the gates. And again, it's a cautionary tale about how we can avoid a war with China. Ryan.
Admiral Andre Ganuela here. So 2034, it's coming out on March 9th. Certainly, I'll be 37 years old by the year 2034. But what exactly inspired you to write this book at this point in time?
What inspired me, Andre, was my concern over the increasing level of tension between two nuclear-armed powers, the United States and China, who have a rich basket of disagreements. So let's go through them very quickly. One is cyber. We're already in a kind of shadowy cyber war with China. Second is trade and tariff disputes. Third is COVID and the origins of COVID. Fourth is the construction of artificial islands in the South China Sea and China's claims to own the entire South China Sea. And then fifth and finally, it's the intellectual property theft, which has really been going on for a decade and longer. So a rich basket of disagreements. And the one that worries me the most is our dispute over the South China Sea. Huge body of water. It's the size of the Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico combined. And China claims it as territorial waters. They want it because it's full of hydrocarbons, oil and gas, and become 40% of the world's trade passes through it. U.S. regards it as high seas. That's a significant disagreement. It could be a flashpoint. It's the opening scene of 2034, a novel of the next world war. So those are some of the reasons I'm concerned right now.
Admiral, you've mentioned many fascinating topics that are covered in your book, that being cyber, the South China Sea. But I want to start with cyber warfare. We've talked about it a lot on the podcast. And so there's been a large uptick in state-sanctioned cyber attacks in the last 15 years, particularly from Russia and China. We've also seen Iran and North Korea. But the SolarWinds hack, which has been attributed to Russia, has elicited significant concern over the U.S. preparedness on the cyber warfare front. And many refer to cyber warfare as the new domain, the next domain of warfare. And so the U.S. military and its cyber capabilities are coordinated under Cyber Command, which is a structure we've talked about a lot on this podcast. But in recent publications, you have expressed and voiced your concern about the U.S. preparedness. And so you've also called for a cyber force becoming a new branch of the U.S. military. And so, Admiral, why do you think that CyberCom is maybe not structured adequately to address the threats, or why do you think there should be a new branch of the U.S. military?
Yeah, a couple of points to be made here. First of all, we ought to just take a step back and say, why are so many attacks occurring? Why are these numbers going so vertical in terms of numbers of attacks and span of attacks? And there are many reasons, including the geopolitics, but there's a fundamental technical reason, and it's called the expansion of the Internet of Things. So let's go back 10 years ago to 2011, when there were about 7 billion devices connected to the Internet, roughly one for every human being on the planet. Come forward to today, there are between 30 and 40 billion devices connected to the Internet, including everything from my iPhone, which I'm holding up right now. And of course, I can open my garage door now. That's great. But 30 to 40 billion devices is an enormous expansion of the threat surface. It allows so many more points of intrusion into our cyber domain. And you're right to call it the new domain of warfare. So that brings us to how do we best structure to protect ourselves given this enormous expansion? And a pretty practical example of the risk is, in fact, the SolarWinds hack, which you can think of in a military context as carpet bombing. I mean, this hit 400 out of the 500 Fortune 500 companies, all of the branches of the armed forces, essentially the entire government. This was a massive carpet bombing followed by precision-guided strikes. So with that as a practical example, and with this enormous threat surface, we should think about how do we best structure ourselves to protect ourselves in the cyber domain. We don't have time to unpackage all of that, but I'll give you my top three, if I could. And you mentioned a couple of them. Number one on my list, create a cyber force. We have an Army, a Navy, an Air Force, a Marine Corps. We just created a Space Force. Good move. We need a cyber force. Doesn't have to be big. 15,000 people would do it. We have 1.5 million people in the armed forces. Surely we can carve out 15,000 to focus on this domain of warfare. So that's kind of number one. Number two is we've got to get cyber awareness to the cabinet level in the U.S. government. If you think about the U.S. cabinet, it's perfectly structured for the 19th century. We have a Secretary of Agriculture, which made a lot of sense when 65% of Americans worked on farms. Today, about 5% do. We have a Secretary of the Interior who manages 380 national parks, important work, and above all, works on Native American reservations around the country. Those are important jobs, both of them, ag and of course, the idea of the interior. But neither is remotely as important to us as cyber. Yet we have nobody at cabinet level who focuses on cyber. So we ought to either take the Director of National Intelligence, cabinet level job, make that person Director of National Intelligence and Cybersecurity, put that portfolio at cabinet level, or take the director of the Cybersecurity Institute, if you will, the agency that is within the Department of Homeland Security. It's below the Secretary of Homeland Security. take that individual, move him or her up to cabinet level. So that's number two, cabinet level representation. Number three, you just alluded to it. Currently, U.S. Cyber Command and the National Security Agency are combined, and they're under one person, a military officer. I know you've had my good friend Mike Rogers on this podcast, and he might disagree with me on this, but I believe NSA and Cyber Command are two different functions. The former is intelligence. The latter is warfighting and defense of the nation's cyber infrastructure. Those are two very different functions. They ought to have different people in charge of them. The span of control is too big for one individual. I think if we split NSA and Cyber Command, we'd be better prepared in this space. So there's three quick ideas. I've got about 20 more that we don't have time to go through right now, Ryan.
So, Admiral, I want to dig a bit deeper into those some of those ideas, because I guess many or some analysts saw the SolarWinds hack as more so an act of cyber espionage rather than as a cyber attack. So in your idea, would a prospective cyber force have had any involvement in preventing a SolarWinds-style hack or these acts of cyber espionage? And should there be military retaliation for an act of cyber espionage?
Let me take the back end of your question first. Should there be military retaliation for an act of cyber espionage? I think the answer, in my view, is it depends. And so we've got to understand what is an attack in the world of cyber. So let's start at the benign end of this. And the benign end would be actions by an adversary that are, if you will, garden variety espionage, trying to get into our nets, trying to find out bits and pieces of information. The next level up would be what I would categorize as SolarWinds, which is massive. So the fundamental answer to the first part of your question, why does SolarWinds matter, is scale. It's the size of this. It is so directed at enormous tranches of our society, I think that it rises to the level of an attack. When you move further up that spectrum of what's an attack, Andre, you get into manipulation of data. Now, we haven't seen that, but we're still investigating whether that occurred. Next level up would be destruction of data. Again, can't attribute that yet to what happened at SolarWinds. Stay tuned. Next level up is when an adversary does something that translates into the physical space. So think the Iranian attempt to intrude into a water dam system in upstate New York. Think the attack by North Korea on Sony Pictures, destroying the IT infrastructure. Hundreds of millions of dollars of damage, by the way. And the next level up, of course, would be attacks on critical infrastructure. So I agree with the thrust of your question, Andre, that, well, wait a minute, SolarWinds, isn't that down in garden variety espionage? I would say it's one click up and does hit the level that would require an actual retaliation. And we've already seen our national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, a couple of days before we take this podcast, come out and say, yes, there will be reaction, retaliation. You try and keep these things proportional. We're not going to go and attack Russian forces in response to this in the physical domain. But I think a proportional response would be something very similar that happens in Russia, a big campaign. You want to be careful. You don't want to escalate. But I do think SolarWinds is big enough to demand a response.
So, Admiral, you talked about one of the most important features of creating a cyber force, that being personnel. And Andre and I have talked about the importance of personnel, particularly when we're looking at cyber force, U.S. Cyber Command. And so in your view, what would a cyber soldier look like? And do we need to rethink what our idea of a typical U.S. soldier is, particularly when we have competition between the U.S. military and the private sector competing for cyber talent?
I would love to show a cartoon I have right now, which I often do when I'm giving presentations. And it shows a big, huge military guy with his razor blade sunglasses and massive biceps and his guns and just totally tricked out for war kind of look. And then behind him in a corner of a cartoon is a little skinny looking guy who kind of looks like me. I'm 5'5", 140 pounds, little skinny guy in the back, kind of waving his hand saying, "Yo, dude, I'm back here." The cyber soldier is, in fact, that little guy in the back. It's not going to be the big stereotypical driven soldier warrior that we think of. We're going to need those guys and gals also. But the cyber soldier is going to be not necessarily a small person, obviously, but it's going to be someone who has devoted his or her early years to the deep study of cyber. And by the way, that means, Ryan, not just cyber policy, but most importantly, coding, computer science, understanding exactly how these systems work. You need both. And I mentioned a number earlier. I'd say it's somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 folks. We are going to have to pay them more, as you point out, because we're competing with our friends in Silicon Valley. But we have a history of doing that in the military. We pay SEALs more. We pay our fighter pilots more. We pay our physicians more. We have always put extra dollars against specific skill sets. So that's a well-trodden path. This might be the highest paid people in the department, potentially. But here I'll close on this. At the core of all of the people I've mentioned, the biggest, strongest Navy SEAL to the most effete computer scientist, at the core of all of them is not money, it's not fame, it's service. And at their core, they want to be part of something larger than themselves. They're very willing, I think, to take less money, less prestige, can't be on that new startup, but they get to be part of defending the country. It's the price you pay for the right to serve. And we've seen men and women stand and deliver on that premise for well over 200 years, and I think it'll continue to be the case in the cyber force.
Certainly, sir. And now, Admiral, while we've discussed this very brand new domain of warfare and potential cyber force, let's now talk about one of the oldest domains, a domain you are well qualified to discuss as an admiral, naval warfare. So, Admiral, how crucial is U.S. naval power right now? And how would you classify the state of the U.S. Navy?
Maritime power continues to be central to our nation's defenses. And part of the reason, of course, Andre, is simply geography. In many ways, we're kind of an island nation, in a sense. We have two vast oceans, if you will, to the left and the right, totally benign neighbors to the north and the south, a pretty good position to be in. Our disagreements, if you will, particularly at the moment, at the high national level, are in distant places that you get to over the oceans. So it's in the South China Sea. It's in the Arabian Gulf. It's in the North Arabian Sea. It is in the high north, the Arctic. It's in the Baltic. That's where our disagreements currently occur. So you need a big, capable Navy simply because of geography. Number two, specifically in great power competition where we can't simply overwhelm an opponent the way we could in Afghanistan, Iraq, or if we had to in North Korea or Iran, we're not going to simply overwhelm Russia or China. Therefore, we have got to be able to go and operate in theaters of war that are on the shores of those two nations. So that, again, means a big, capable Navy that can take a punch from a near-peer competitor and keep on going. And then third and finally, our maritime forces are a big part of, in, if you will, a domain of concern we ought to have, and that's the environment. We ought to be capable of understanding what's happening on the oceans of the world, not just because of geopolitics and war fighting, but because we're in another kind of war. We're in a conflict to reduce the damage that's being done to the planet on the oceans. We're going to do that, and if you will, take the oceans back from polluters, overfishers, things that are going to change the fundamental chemistry of the oceans, the melting of the ice caps, we're going to need navies to do that. So I think the case is very strong for the U.S. Navy. You ask, what's the state of it? It's too small for the task at hand. We've got, in really round numbers, about 300 ships in the U.S. Navy. By the way, China has about 450. Our naval forces are less numerous, but more capable, certainly, than China's. We have massive nuclear aircraft carriers, large deck amphibious ships, but we are still too small for the task at hand. This is something, by the way, the Trump and the Biden administration agree on. We have, obviously, the shipbuilding blueprint that the Trump administration laid out, which would move us toward 450 to 500 ships. I think that's warships. I think that's about the right number. From all indications, we're still early days, but my friends in the Biden administration, my good friend, Army General Lloyd Austin, believe me, as Secretary of Defense, the first question coming out of his mouth when something goes wrong is, where are the carriers? And that has been true for every Secretary of Defense and every president. And then secondly, the new Deputy Secretary of Defense, Kathleen Hicks, Dr. Hicks, is someone who understands naval forces, gave a speech a couple of days before the taping of this podcast about the importance of shipbuilding. So I think we're too small for the big task at hand. The fundamental logic is there. Look for a Navy that expands in the coming years, largely because of near-peer competitive pressures from China and Russia.
Admiral, your insights are getting me thinking about your forthcoming book, 2034. And so I want to circle back to the South China Sea and focus on that in particular. In one respect, just because of the importance of Freedom of Navigation Operations, FON, something that the Biden administration is committed to continuing. And so China, as you said, has had these maritime claims, their nine-dash line in the South China Sea. They've constructed artificial islands and are aggressively posturing against their neighbors. And so what does the United States Navy need to do to ensure that, one, we preserve freedom of navigation, but also don't find ourselves kind of on the warpath to ensure that the United States isn't going to accidentally find itself in a world war?
Yeah. Again, thanks for mentioning 2034. And without giving away anything, I'll tell you, the book begins in the South China Sea with an incident between the maritime forces of the U.S. Navy and China. And I think that is, unfortunately, the most realistic and dangerous potential flashpoint between our nations right now. Because events happen at sea, and I can tell you this as someone who commanded a destroyer in my 30s, these are young people. I was the oldest person on the ship in a crew of 400. These are young people out at sea, both on U.S. ships and Chinese ships. These are young fighter pilots in their 20s flying overhead, driving submarines under the ocean. These aren't mature, fully formed, policy-making senior officials. These are young guys and gals who are out there defending the nation. And there can be a miscalculation. So we ought to be very concerned about it. You mentioned South China Sea. Again, it's huge. It's an enormous body of water. It's the size of the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico combined. And China has so far built nine very capable artificial islands, as you mentioned, Ryan, that have airstrips, missiles, tanks, troops. You know, there's another name for those artificial islands. In the Navy, we call them unsinkable aircraft carriers. China will use them to operate forward into the first and second island chains, which is a term of art about the lines where there might be conflict in the South China Sea and Western Pacific. And you can't sink those islands. We can go kind of blow them up, but they can quickly be restructured. It's a clever strategy. It's another indication of the tension. So bottom line, what should the U.S. Navy be doing? First of all, have clear rules of engagement. Train our sailors, our airmen, our submariners, our Marine Corps. Train them to be steady and understand where those rules of engagement are. Number two, we've got to go in there and we've got to operate. That's what freedom of navigation is all about. It's showing not only the Chinese, but the international community, the international courts, that we, the United States, regard the South China Sea, in my view correctly, as high seas, international waters. To prove that claim, we drive our destroyers right through it. And, you know, some might say the Chinese look at that as though we're driving a car through their neighborhood, driving donut holes in their front lawn. I can see why they get agitated about it. But they don't own those waters. Those are international waters. That's high seas. And if we allow China to simply claim that huge body of water, what comes next? Does the United States claim the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Sea? Does Russia claim the entire Black Sea? On and on and on. So I think there's good strategic rationale, and the way we show that we believe in freedom of high seas navigation, and by the way, this is also aviation. We fly long-range planes right over it. We sail our destroyers and our aircraft carriers through that Taiwan Strait, and China doesn't like it. And I think it's unfortunate that China feels as though these are territorial waters. We're going to have to, at some point, adjudicate that claim, hopefully using diplomacy, international courts, economic tools to convince our friends in Beijing that, no, those really are high seas. That's a very fundamental disagreement, going to have to be resolved. The predicate of 2034 is a world in which that was not resolved. And I would say if we don't resolve it right about 15 years from now, when you two characters are in your mid-30s, is when we are at greatest risk of war. That's why I wrote the book.
So, Admiral, we've talked about the future of warfare, both in terms of future domains of warfare and also in terms of this flashpoint in the South China Sea. But another huge aspect and factor of warfare are alliances, geopolitical alliances. And Admiral, you were very well qualified to answer this next question because you were the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. So now, when we assess the state of NATO, we've seen the alliance have some difficulties, I guess, in the last few years. Certainly, we've seen some political criticisms from within the United States regarding the idea that perhaps partner countries are not contributing their fair share. We've seen some democratic backsliding in some member states, and we've seen some difficulties with one of the member states, Turkey. So, Admiral, how would you classify the state of NATO as it is right now?
I think NATO remains capable and a force for good globally, but it has some challenges, and you alluded to several of them. Let me first lay out the case for NATO, and then very quickly I'll tell you the challenges that I see. I think the case for NATO from a U.S. perspective is pretty simple, actually. Let's start with defense budgets. U.S., as listeners to your podcast will know, spends, you know, let's really round numbers, let's call it $600, $650 billion a year on defense. China spends about $200, $250 billion. Russia spends only about $100 billion. Guess how much those, quote, freeloading, quote, Europeans spend? Europe collectively spends well over $300 billion. It's the second largest defense budget in the world. And by the way, they spend almost more than Russia and China combined. So first of all, they've got money. We would like to see them spend a bit more, but it would be pretty foolish to walk away from the second largest defense budget in the world. Number two, geography. Europe is strategically critical. It is, you know, people would say to me when I was Supreme Allied Commander, you know, why do we have all those old Cold War bases in Europe? Wrong. Those are the forward operating stations of the 21st century. That's where we can surge our material, our military capability to move on into the Arabian Gulf, into Africa, into Asia. Third, the Europeans stand with us. They are our greatest pool of partners. The only time Article 5, the attack on one is an attack on all clause of the NATO Charter was activated was 9/11. The Europeans came with us to Afghanistan. I signed 1,700 letters of condolence to servicemen and women who died under my command in Afghanistan. almost 900 were to Europeans. This is a group of people in Europe who stand with us. And fourth and finally, maybe most importantly, they share our values. These are democracies. This is the largest pool of partners we're going to find in the world operating kind of collectively in the European Union. So I would say it's a pretty good case. The challenges, and you alluded to a couple of them, are, there's some, if you will, storm warning flags in some of the member states where some aspects of democracy are under pressure, kind of in Eastern Europe. You mentioned Turkey. I think those are real concerns. If we want to address those, the best way to do that is to continue to lead inside the NATO alliance. So we got to watch that. But I think by and large, Europe is still quite capable in that regard. And then secondly, you mentioned what sometimes is called burden sharing, you know, the balance between U.S. spending and European spending. The Europeans have agreed to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. Not all of them are meeting that goal at this point. In fact, out of the 28 NATO nations, non-U.S., 29 now, I would say probably only 9, maybe 10 are meeting that goal. So the rest of them have made a commitment by the middle of this decade to get up to 2% of GDP. So we need to keep the pressure on in that regard. And I think you'll see the Biden administration continue to do so. And then third and finally, sometimes people say, well, you know, does NATO really have a mission anymore now that the Soviet Union is gone? I think so. Certainly, as the commander, I led missions in Afghanistan, Libya, the Balkans, on counter-piracy, in cybersecurity. We're seeing Russia invade Ukraine, not a NATO member, but a close partner and friend. They threaten the Baltic states constantly. There's great tension in the Arctic, where there are 5 NATO nations across the Arctic Sea from Russia. I would say the answer to the question, does NATO have a mission, is open up the newspaper. Plenty of missions out there. So bottom line, Andre, NATO is now a venerable organization. It's been around for decades. I think it's still highly capable, good value for the United States, and very much has a mission, albeit some challenges we're going to have to face together.
And on that note, Admiral Stavridis, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure. And I also want to thank you for your service to this country. To all of you listening, please make sure to check out the Admiral's new book, 2034, releasing in under 2 weeks. And we will link the Admiral's website where you can find his other many books, articles, and public appearances. Sir, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Ryan and Andre, thank you. I do a fair amount of these podcasts. I want to congratulate you both on the high quality of the questions and your own knowledge of defense. And I hope both of you will continue to stay engaged in national security and find ways to serve the country, because there are so many ways to serve this country. Certainly the military is a great option, but our Peace Corps, our diplomats, our CIA officers, our cyber professionals, our police, our firemen, our medical personnel. There's a lot of ways to serve the country, including teaching and education. Let's all try and find a way to serve the country. That's my real message for the morning. Thank you very much to you both, Ryan and Andre.
Admiral, thank you so much for joining us today.
To hear other fascinating conversations, subscribe to the podcast and follow us on social media at Burnbag Pod. Thank you for listening. This is the Burnbag Podcast.